Let me ask you a question to start off with, brethren. Do dreams really have meanings? Some of them, all of them, or none of them? In the last time I gave a sermon, we did a Bible study from the book of Daniel, and we were talking about one prophetic, meaningful dream and vision of Nebuchadnezzar. And I mentioned that I had researched on dreams a little bit, and according to the so-called scientific experts, most dreams are resonance of neural circuits, or like electricity on the brain. But for God's people, that's the question, are some of our dreams perhaps sometimes a nudge from God in order to shift our minds in a certain direction? That's a question. Okay, so again, the question, are some of our dreams perhaps sometimes a nudge from God to shift our minds in a certain direction? And I ask this question because a few weeks ago, I had a strange dream. And again, it may have just been random electricity on my brain, but maybe not. Let me give you the record of my dream. First of all, I remember in the dream some kind of sports activity. Might have been a church-related one, perhaps a YOU track meet in the 80s or whatever, but another person and I had the job of measuring what was thrown. It might have been a discus or a shot or a javelin, I can't remember. But as sometimes happens in dreams, the scene changed, the perceived location changed, and the next thing I remember, we were inside a building, kind of a dingy basement actually in a building, and we were measuring inside the building. Now for our measurements, we had a measuring tape, but the measuring tape was way too short, and that was very frustrating, and it made our multiple measurements necessary, and they had to be added together. And we got even more frustrated because we had no paper or pencil to add the things up with to record the measurements, and we didn't have a calculator. And my mental arithmetic skills are so bad that I kept losing track of the total length that we were supposed to be measuring. That was my dream. And as with many dreams, there's no happy ending, no logical or sensible ending. I woke up with the same feeling of frustration, but I was also wondering if perhaps there was a lesson in it. Was God trying to nudge me into thinking about something? To nudge me into thinking in a certain direction? Something that I should have been thinking about perhaps, but I had not been? And if so, what was that something? Well, I do know, though, that the main theme of the dream was measurement. Measurement. And what do most Christians and other Bible students too think of when we hear the words measurement or measure? We usually think about the measuring of the temple. And this was a train of thought that dream led me into. And so for this sermon today, let's do a Bible study again on the subject of measuring the temple. And it's actually an appropriate subject for this time of year as we lead up to the Passover. So let's start off with, in the book of Ezekiel, we'll look at Ezekiel's temple measuring prophecies. Now, the study of the building of God's tent tabernacle and later the stone temples make it obvious, if we look into those things, that many measurements needed to be made in order to fulfill God's specific instructions regarding size and design. Now, today we're not going to go into the fine detail of the physical tent tabernacle and the stone temples, but what I do want to look at is the spiritual aspects of the measuring of God's temples. Now, there are a few places where we could begin the study, but I chose to begin in the book of Ezekiel. So please turn to Ezekiel chapter 40, and again, please have a bookmark available because I'm going to be jumping around a little bit. Ezekiel chapter 40 and verse 1. In the 25th year of our, and that's Judah's, captivity, at the beginning of the year, on the 10th day of the month, please note, on the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after the city, Jerusalem, was captured, on the very same day, the hand of the Lord was upon me, and he took me there. Now, it's interesting that God inspired this vision to be given during the final lead-up to Passover. It was on the 10th day of Abib, or Nisan, on the day that he commanded the Passover lambs to be chosen and closely observed. It was the beholding of the lambs day. Continuing in verse 2, in the visions of God, he took me into the land of Israel and set me on a very high mountain. On it, toward the south, was something like the structure of a city. He took me there, and behold, there was a man, probably an angel, we think, whose appearance was like the appearance of bronze. He had a line of flax and a measuring rod in his hand, and he stood in the gateway. So he had a line of flax and a measuring rod in his hand. And the Bible, many Bible scholars looking into those terms there, suggest that one of these devices was to measure broadly and the other one was to measure in detail. That's kind of it. Verse 4. And the man said to me, Son of man, look with your eyes and hear with your ears and fix your mind on everything I show you. For you were brought here so that I might show them to you. Declare to the house of Israel everything you see. Oh, poor Ezekiel, I hope, unlike me in my dream, that he took a notebook along with him because he had a lot to remember. God told him through this angel to record everything that he saw. Verse 5. Now, there was a wall all around the outside of the temple. Note that, is the temple. In the man's hand was a measuring rod, 6 cubits long, each being a cubit and a handbreadth. And he measured the width of the wall structure, 1 rod, and the height, 1 rod. Now, most scholars agree that the cubit that's being talked about here is about 18 inches. So the measuring rod was about 9 feet long. Now, don't want to get into that kind of detail. But the main things that we need to note here is that it was the temple that's being talked about. Hebrew word is bayit. Temple was being measured, and also that there was a whole, throughout this chapter, there was a whole lot of measuring going on, lots of measuring going on, and God wanted Ezekiel to witness it and record it all in detail. Now going to verse 6. Then he went to the gateway which faced east. And he went up its stairs and measured the threshold of the gateway, which was 1 rod wide, and the other threshold was 1 rod wide, and so on. Again, the measuring continues all the way through the whole of the 40th chapter, and it's not necessary for my purpose anyway to read it all now. Now, the Hebrew word for temple here, bayith, B-A-Y-I-T-H, can also mean house. Or, interestingly, tribe. I'll touch on a few points that are relevant to the fact that one of God's temples is being measured here. So let's jump all the way down to verse 38. Verse 38, there was a chamber and its entrance by the gateposts of the gateway where they washed the burnt offering. There's another clue of the temple. Verse 39, in the vestibule of the gateway with the 2 tables on this side and 2 tables on that side, on which to slay the burnt offering, the sin offering, and the trespass offering. Now, subsequent verses to this mention priests, the Levites, the altar, the temple musicians, and then again in verse 45, specifically mentions the temple. Verse 45, then he said to me, this chamber which faces south is for the priests who have charge of the temple. And then again in verse 48, then he brought me to the vestibule of the temple and measured the doorpost of the vestibule, 5 cubits on this side, 5 cubits on that side, and the width of the gateway was 3 cubits on this side, 3 cubits on that side. Now all of this measuring continues into chapter 41. Well, let's go to chapter 41, and again we'll pick out just a few verses for now. Starting in verse 1, Ezekiel chapter 41 and verse 1. Then he brought me into the sanctuary. The Hebrew word is Heikal, H-E-Y-K-A-L, can mean a temple or a palace. And what did he do? He measured the doorposts 6 cubits wide on one side and 6 cubits wide on the other side. The width of the tabernacle, and the word there is ohel, ohel, which means a house, a dwelling, or a home. Jump down to verse 4. He measured the length 20 cubits and the width 20 cubits beyond the sanctuary. And he said to me, this is the most holy place, the most holy place. And we know that that refers to the temple. Verse 15. Again, he measured the length of the building behind it, facing the separating courtyard with its galleries on the one side and on the other side, 100 cubits, as well as the inner temple, again that word is Heikal, and the porches of the court. The thing I'm trying to get at here is the temple is being described here, the measuring of the temple. Now we can be pretty sure that it's not the old tent tabernacle that's being measured, nor Solomon's temple, because by this time, by the time Ezekiel wrote, they were both gone. Probably not the second temple either, Zerubbabel's post-exilic rebuilding, nor Herod's later embellishments, of course, because that one hadn't come on the scene yet, but rather we believe that it's a prophetic depiction of the future temple in the world. And this makes much sense, because if we drop down, let's go all the way down to chapter 43, please, a couple of pages over, and see what God says. Now, this is the same temple that's being talked about, and see this. Ezekiel chapter 43 and verse 7. And he said to me, son of man, this is the place of my throne and the place of the sole of my feet, where I will dwell in the midst of the children of Israel forever. Forever. No more shall the house of Israel defile my holy name, they nor their kings, by the idolatry or with the carcasses of their kings or their high places. Now we know very well that since the time of this prophecy, that God gave this prophecy to Ezekiel, we know very well that the Israelites and kings and their kings have defiled God's name. So we know that when this happens, he says, no more shall the house of Israel. So that's over here. Okay. Let's look at some other temple measuring prophecies. Let's jump over to the book of Revelation chapter 11. And we'll read a similar temple measuring prophecy from Jesus Christ via the Apostle John. Revelation chapter 11, please. Revelation chapter 11 and verse 1. Then, the Apostle John, I was given a reed like a measuring rod. Very similar to what happened back in the man, the angel had it. And the angel stood saying, rise and measure the temple of God, the altar, and those who worship there. But leave out the court, which is outside the temple, and do not measure it, for it has been given to the Gentiles, and they will tread the holy city underfoot for 42 months. I'm going to come back to that. Other prophecies tell us, as well as a measuring rod or tape, that something else is necessary, what the Bible calls, the King James Bible calls, a plummet, or it's called a plumb line in modern versions, and it's still today. A plumb line is necessary in order to see if the building and the temple is plumb or straight and true and perpendicular, and that is spiritually important. Let's jump over to Amos. Let's jump back to Amos chapter 7. And I can never find these minor prophets, so an extra minute there. Amos chapter 7. I should get one of those Bibles. Amos chapter 7 and verse 7. Amos 7 verse 7. Thus he showed me, behold, the Lord stood on a wall made with a plumb line, with a plumb line in his hand. And the Lord said to me, Amos, what do you see? And I said, a plumb line. Then the Lord said, behold, I am setting a plumb line in the midst of my people, Israel. I will not pass by them any more. So here, the prophet Amos sees the Lord holding a plumb line in his hand, and he's standing on a wall that was built using a plumb line. And that might imply that when that wall was originally built, that it was straight. Then the Lord tells Amos, and us too, in spiritual Israel today, that he's setting a plumb line in the midst of his people, Israel. Why? What is the reason for the plumb line? In order to give them the standard to line themselves up against, and us too. To give us the standard to line ourselves up against, apply the same standard to Israel of God, the Church of God. But what is the standard? What is God's standard? What is the standard of Jesus Christ? God tells us through the prophet Isaiah. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 28. Isaiah chapter 28 and verse 17. Also, I will make justice the measuring line and righteousness the plummet. So God doesn't leave us in the dark. He gives us the answers, and what is the measuring line? It's justice. What is the plummet? It's righteousness. Please notice that it's God who retains the authority to set the symbolism. God retains the authority to set the symbolism as to what is his measuring line and his plumb line. And he clearly tells us the interpretation. The measuring line spiritually represents true justice. The Hebrew word is mishpat, M-I-S-H-P-A-T. And interestingly, that same word can also mean measure. It can mean the word measure too. So that's really topical. But it can also mean judgment, law, order, worthiness, and discretion. It can mean all of those things. This is God's measuring line. What's God's plumb line? He said it's true righteousness. And the Hebrew word is, let me have a go at this one, tzedokah. And I've got this transliterated as T-S-E-D-A-W-K-A-W, tzedokah, a blackbird's call or something, anyway. But it can also mean, as well as righteousness, it can mean right and righteous acts. So we know what the measuring line is, we know what the plumb line is. So please keep these definitions in mind, and we'll come back to them later. Let's go on to another prophet's mention of the measuring of the temple. This time Zechariah. This is a really interesting one. Zechariah, please, chapter 4. Zechariah chapter 4. We'll jump in at verse 10. Zechariah chapter 4 and verse 10. For who has despised the day, and this is a very well verse for God's people. For who has despised the day of small things? For these seven rejoice to see the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel. They are the eyes of the Lord, which scan to and fro throughout the whole earth. Now, the question we've all asked for many years is this question from Zechariah. Who has despised the things? Well-known question to all by. And we wondered what the small things refer to and how this question is even relevant to the plumb line that Zerubbabel is carrying. Now, there's a Bible translation called a Targum, an ancient Bible translation called a Targum, which is an Aramaic translation, and it renders this verse as, "Who is he that despises this day because the building is small? Who is he that despises this day because building is small?" And I think there's a good possibility there that this might refer to the small size of Zerubbabel's temple, the second temple, because we know that it was relatively small and inferior compared to the other scriptures that mention that, which we don't need to go to. Now, Zechariah chapter 4, which we just read, it mentions these seven who rejoiced to see Zerubbabel with a plumb line in his hand. And I looked at, I read that. What's he talking about? And to find out, you have to go back to the beginning of the chapter. Let's go back to verse 1, still in chapter 4. Go back to verse 1. "Now the angel who talked with me came back and wakened me, as a man who is wakened out of his sleep. And he said to me, 'What do you see?' I'm looking, and there's a lampstand of solid gold with a bowl on top of it, and on the stand seven lamps with seven pipes to the..." Verse 3, "Two olive trees are by it, one at the right of the bowl, and the other at its left." So the words "these seven" in verse 10 are referring to the seven lamps and pipes. So we believe that this is the lampstand that is made for temple, specifically the temple that's being referred to here. And again, I don't want to get into too much detail. I don't want to get off track with this, but I do want to tie it in with the temple measurements in Revelation chapter 11. So before we go there, let's just continue in Zechariah chapter 4. Okay, verse 8. "Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me," Zechariah, "saying, 'The hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this temple.'" So this new rebuilding of the temple after exile. "'His hands shall also finish it. Then you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you.'" Now this clinches the fact that God's temple is again being referred to. I'm going to repeat verse 10. "For who has despised the day of small things? For these seven rejoice to see the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel. They are the eyes of the Lord, which scan to and fro throughout the whole earth. Then I answered and said to him, 'What are these two olive trees of the lampstand and at its left?' And I further answered and said to him, 'What are these two olive branches that drip into the receptacles of the two gold pipes from which the golden oil drains?' Then he answered me and said, 'Do you not know what these are?' And I said, 'No, my Lord.' So he said, 'These are the two anointed ones who stand beside the Lord of the whole earth.'" And now we have a link to Revelation chapter 11. So Zerubbabel built this temple in approximately 500. Well, we ask the question, could Zechariah 4, could it be dual with a prophetic and spiritual fulfillment? Well, let's go to Revelation chapter 11 and we'll see. Revelation chapter 11. Revelation chapter 11 and verse 3. "And I will give power to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy 1260 days clothed in..." Verse 4, "These are the two trees and the two lampstands standing before the God of the earth." So again, I don't want to get too far off the main topic of measuring the temple, but it appears that both of these prophecies from Zechariah and Revelation refer to... let's talk a little bit about God and his people being the ultimate temple. Up until 70 AD, we know that God had his 10 tabernacles way back at the beginning. And then he had his stone temples. He had a couple of stone temples. And they were important. I mean, if God commanded them to be built, but important as they were, these physical temples were merely physical symbols of their spiritual counterparts. Now, there may be more, but I count three spiritual temples. There may actually be more. First of all, there's God's throne in heaven right now. And we believe that that the design of the stone temples and the tent tabernacles were designed on the pattern from God's throne in heaven. The second one, the second spiritual counterpart right now, is the people, I should say, are the people of God's true church, collectively, and again, right now. God's true people represent the temple of God. And of course, God the Father, this is number three, God the Father, Jesus Christ, and the resurrected saints in the world tomorrow. Let's say the world tomorrow to a certain extent during the millennium, and then at the end of the millennium, following it into the kingdom of God, the eternal kingdom of God, once God the Father is reunited with resurrected mankind fully at that time. We're going to come to those wonderful verses later on. So again, let's look at some scriptures that support the full aspects of the temples. First one, from Jesus Christ himself, telling the Jews that even in his human form, he was the true temple of God. Let's go to John chapter 2, please. Book of John chapter 2. John chapter 2. And verse 19. John chapter 2 and verse 19. Jesus answered and said unto them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. And then said the Jews, this temple and building, and will you rear it up? But he was speaking of the temple of his body. So Jesus clearly declared that he was, and so is, the temple of God. Now the Jews were unaware that his words that he spoke here within the next few days after he said this did actually use these words against him in their accusations to have him killed. They also, as he hung on the stake, they mocked him with these. What did the Apostle Paul say? On the Apostle Paul had lots to say on this subject. Let's just look at a few instances. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 3. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 16. Do you not know that you are the temple of God? Talking to church members in the Corinth congregation. Do you know that you are the temple of God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? And that's supremely important too, is that indwelling of the Holy Spirit that makes us his temple. If anyone defiles the temple of God, God will destroy him. For the temple of God is holy, which temple you are. So he repeats for emphasis there, parts of the temple of God. Why? Again, why? And how? And the reason is that Jesus Christ lives in us through, and we know that Jesus Christ are the temple. The Apostle Paul also warns here, against anyone defiling God's temple. Now, how can we defile God's temple? Well, there's various ways that we can, but the Apostle Paul comes back to it in chapter 6. Let's jump over to chapter 6. And again, we can look at these words physically or spiritually. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 15. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? Certainly not. Let's jump down to verse 18. Verse 18. Flee sexual immorality. And again, we know what was going on in Corinth there, and certainly physically it was a problem, but we can look at that spiritually as well and know that spiritual immorality, probably even more dangerous than every sin that a man does is outside the body. But he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. I don't have to explain all of the. Or do you not know that your body, again, is the temple of the Holy Spirit which is in you, which you have from God, and you are not your own? For you were bought at a price, therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit. Now let's go over to 2 Corinthians, because in 2 Corinthians, the Apostle Paul in a couple of places reminds the brethren there what he warned them in his first letter to them. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, 2 Corinthians chapter 6, and what agreement has the temple of God, that's us, is, you know, in the Corinth congregation, and what agreement has the temple of God with us? For you are the temple of the Lord. As God has said, I will dwell in them. See how when he mentions that you are the temple of God, dwelling in us, that makes us the temple of God. I will dwell in them and walk among them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Now, the Apostle Paul clearly laid this out. He sent this message to members in Corinth. We asked the question, was it only the Corinthian brethren who made up God's temple? Of course not. To other congregations too. Ephesians chapter 2. Let's go over to Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 19, please. 2 verse 19. Now, therefore, you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God. Now, the English word household is an acceptable translation. It comes from the Greek word oikios, O-I-K-E-I-O-S in the Greek. But there seems to be a double entendre here from the Apostle Paul. The Apostle Paul was wonderful with words, he really was. As well as implying the God family membership here, with using the household of God, this word can also be translated house, as in a building and a temple, of course. This second meaning becomes clear as he continues. Verse 20. Having been built on the foundation, and we know right away what he's talking about here then, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, Jesus Christ and being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, he's gone from household to a building here, a house, being joined together, grows into a holy temple. So we know what kind of building it is, what kind of house it is, grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built, that's important, are being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. Words, wonderful promises, wonderful fact. So the references in the letters of the Apostle Paul to the Corinthians that we've read so far, they might lead us to believe that God's people were then in Corinth and in Ephesus, that they were complete, that their temple building was complete at that time. And we might say to ourselves, this looks pretty good. Our part in the temple is complete now. But this mention here in the letter to the Ephesians strongly implies the church members are still in the building process. It says here that we are growing into a holy temple. It said that they were growing at that time into a holy temple, and that we are being built, present tense. And the Apostle Peter said, let's go to 1 Peter in the sermon, even an extended sermon, and I've had to miss out a lot from this one. 1 Peter chapter 2. You also, as living stones, are being, present tense, built up a spiritual house, a stood to offer up spiritual sacrifice acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. So now the second implication here, Peter and Paul to the Ephesians, is is that we are all individual parts of the temple building. We are stones and pillars. And there's quite a few more scriptures on that that I haven't, don't have time to go into. I will pick on a few. And Jesus Christ totally agrees with this concept. He inspired the statements and the Apostle Paul made, but he also countersigns them through the words that he commanded the Apostle John to record again in the book of Revelation. So let's go back to Revelation, chapter 3, please. Revelation chapter 3. I'm going to jump on one verse there. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 12. Well, he who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. And I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God. That's going to be in the second half of the sermon that we'll come to. The New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I will write on him my new name. Back to that later, but Peter and John recognized their brethren as the spiritual pillars and stones of God's temple. Of course, Paul did too. Let's go back to 1 Timothy. 1 Timothy. 1 Timothy chapter 3. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 15. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 15. I'll just break into a thought here. But if I am delayed, I write so that you may know how you ought to conduct yourself in the house of God, the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the pillar and ground of the truth. Just want to take a quick look at those two words, pillar and ground. Let's do it the other way around. Ground, first of all, is a poor translation of the Greek word hedrioma, hedrioma, H-E-D-R-A-I-O-M-A, hedrioma. And it actually means a stay, a prop, or a support. That's what ground means there. And the Greek word for pillar is stoulos, stoulos, S-T-U-L-O-S. Derived from the word stuo, which means to stiffen. And it refers to, again, a column, a prop, or a support. You can imagine these big buildings that were built in those days, most of them for pagan use, unfortunately, and that they, just wonderful engineering for that later on, too. Okay, the main thing is, though, that I'm trying to get that, is that the pillars of any building, but especially those of God's holy temple, must be rigid, they must be straight, they must be strong, and they must be of adequate circumference. We see the need then for a plumb line to make sure they're straight, and we see the need for an accurate measurement of their sizes to ensure that the pillars and all of the other parts of all are straight and true. Let's continue now, and what I'd like to do now is I'd like to start pointing this towards the upcoming Passover, and I'd like to ask this question. Are we as pillars and stones actively measuring ourselves? Are we measuring our own individual parts of God's temple to see if they are straight and of adequate size? As we draw close to the Passover, we all know that we're to put a high priority on examining ourselves. Let's, maybe for the first time this year, let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 28 and just pull out this one verse for now. I know that over the next couple of weeks we're going to be going through this in a lot more detail, but I just 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 28. But let a man examine himself, let a man measure himself, if you will, and so let him eat of that bread and drink of that cup. And we know that, especially prior to the Passover service, we need to be doing this. But also we know on a regular, ongoing basis throughout the year. Let's go over to 2 Corinthians chapter 13, just to make sure that we know this as well. 2 Corinthians chapter 13, and again, just one verse here. 2 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 5. Examine yourselves, and say measure yourselves, as to whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. Again, we could say measure yourselves. Do you not know yourselves that Jesus Christ is in you? That's exactly what we've been learning. If we are pillars and stones of the temple of God, that it's because Jesus Christ is in us through his Holy Spirit. Unless indeed, it says, unless indeed you are disqualified. Those two verses there. Now, of course, it is important for us to measure our own personal parts, stones, pillars of the temple. I'm going to ask you a question here now, because it sounds pretty judgmental. I'm going to ask you this question. Is it wrong to measure our neighboring pillars also, to a certain extent? Is it wrong to measure our neighboring pillar to a certain extent in order to see if they measure up and are straight? Now, I think you'll see that it's important that this as we go along. Let's go back to the book of Revelation, please. Revelation chapter 11. Revelation chapter 11. Something really jumped out at me here when I read this again. Revelation chapter 11 and verse 1. Then I was given, this is the Apostle John here, in it, if you will. Then I was given a reed like a measuring rod, and the angel stood, saying, rise and measure the temple of God, the altar, and those who worship there. But, verse 2, leave out the court, which is outside the temple, and do not measure it. For it has been given to the Gentiles, and they will tread the holy city underfoot for 42 months. And I don't want to get into all of the prophetic aspect of that, but really the fact that John was told to rise, measure the temple, the altar, and those who worship there, but not to measure the court which is outside that was given to the Gentiles. Okay, he was not given authority to measure anything outside the temple itself. Again, only the temple, the altar, and those who worship there. Now I ask another question here, because there's another set of scriptures that seems to be very parallel to this. And I ask if this could be a repetition of God's command for us to righteously judge in the proper way, but not of the world outside. And here it is, it's in 1 Corinthians. Let's go back to 1 Corinthians 5. And this is from the Bible, brethren. These are not my words, these are God's words. You read them for yourself in your own Bibles there. 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 11. But now I have written to you not to keep company with anyone named a brother. These are not Gentiles. These are not referring to peers. This is referring to somebody, anyone named a brother, who is sexually immoral, or covetous, or an idolater, or a reviler, or a drunkard, or an extortioner, not even to eat with such a person. And just reading that verse on its own, we know that a certain level of judgment is required, proper righteous judgment. Verse 12, for what have I to do with judging those also who are outside the church of God, people who are not named as brothers in the church? What have I to do with judging those also who are outside? Do you not judge those who are inside?" In other words, the ones who are called brothers. Verse 13, "Put those who are outside, but those who are outside, God judges. Therefore, put away from yourselves the evil person." I believe that those verses there refer, or like a parallel scripture with those that we just read in the book of Revelation. What is the Apostle Paul referring to? We know he's in 1 Corinthians 5, and we know what that means. Let's just nip back and take a look at it. And again, you can look at these things spiritually or verse 1. "It is actually reported that there is sexual immorality among you. Such sexual immorality is not even named among the Gentiles, that a man has his father's wife. And you are puffed up, and you have not rather mourned that he who has done this deed might be taken away from among you. Brethren, for I indeed," this is the Apostle Paul, "as absent in body, but present in spirit, have already judged, as though I were present, him who has so done this deed." Now, this particular sin, we know that it was a gross immorality, but it could be something else. Those others that we listed further down, you know, there was idolatry, there was drunkenness, there was... The Apostle Paul exercised the right to exercise right judgment for the wrongdoing that was going on in the congregation there. Again, not only for the specific sins, but also for the members' acceptance of them. And probably there were some level of leaders there, we imagine. I don't know whether they were local elders or whatever, but there was an acceptance of them. Judge them for that acceptance as well. Backed by God's authority, the Apostle Paul, a human being now, not God and not an angel, but a human being with the Holy Spirit dwelling in him, lined up these people, if you will, theoretically, who were named brothers. They called themselves brothers within the church. They were nominally pillars in God's temple. And the Apostle Paul lined them up beside the standard, beside Jesus Christ, and he measured them with Jesus' measuring rod and plumb line. And we saw what the definitions were of those earlier. Justice, right, law, order, discretion, and righteous judgment. And he found those brethren there, they needed more work. They needed more chiseling, those pillars, before they could be ready for effective use as pillars and stones in God's temple. So again, we ask the question here, is righteous judgment okay then? Well, of course it is. And Jesus Christ clearly said so. I won't turn back to that verse right now, but Jesus said that we should judge righteous judgment. And there's good reason, that there are good reasons, valid reasons for proper measurement, and we can also call it righteous judgment of our neighbouring pillars. Please consider this in the case of a physical temple. Here we are. We're a pillar in God's temple. Now, if we'd made sure by adhering to the measurements and the standards that Jesus Christ has given us, if we make absolutely sure that we do our best and our pillar is the right height and the right width and the right circumference in order to carry the load placed on it, but some of our neighbor pillars are not, and it's obvious to see that. What if some of them are too long? What if some of them are too short? What if some of them, the circumference is too small? Not only would this building look very odd, it would be unwieldy and it would be in grave danger. Mismatched pillars in God's temple, in order to bear the load that God puts on the temple, is like different animals who are yoked together to pull a plow or a cart. This make, I know I'm mixing metaphors here, but I'm mixing metaphors because the Apostle Paul did exactly that. Please turn over to 2 Corinthians again. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 14. Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. We're talking about people outside the church, as the Apostle Paul talking about. We're not going to yoke ourselves with in a silly way. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? And what communion has light with darkness? And what accord has Christ with Belial? Or what part has a believer with an unbeliever? And what agreement has the temple of God, here it is now, with idols? For you are the temple of the living God. There it is again. As God has said, I will dwell in them and walk among them. I will be their God and they shall be my people. If you would bookmark that, please. Let me ask this question. What if we become aware of some of our fellow temple pillars that are involved in or supporting some of these, like the Corinthians apparently did? Not apparently, they definitely did. What do we do? Well, let's go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 5 again, and we'll see what we're supposed to do. 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 13. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, and I just want one verse here. 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 13. But those who are outside the church of God, God judges. Therefore, put away from yourselves the evil person. That's the answer. Put away from yourselves the evil person. But what if we don't have the authority to put a person away from our fellowship, the evil person away from our fellowship? What if his actions or her actions are approved or supported by the church leadership? What do we do then? What are we supposed to do then? God tells us, if we can't put the evil person away from ourselves, then, brethren, we must put ourselves away from the evil. Let's go back to our bookmark again. In 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 17. And again, these are not my words, these are God's words. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 17, therefore, come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will receive you. Well, God knew that such separation would be painful for us, is painful for us, but he commanded it as a necessity nevertheless. And he gives us that comfort that he will receive us that comfort if we do these things. And again, I'm not talking about something that also said something about, you know, not something minor, but you know what I'm talking about when I say that we're talking about something major and something that is ongoing and that is not being changed. Okay, let's carry on and let's talk about the Shore Foundation. In a few weeks' time, Trish and I look forward to seeing the Leaning Tower of Pisa. We're going to Italy. And the Leaning Tower of Pisa is very interesting. They started building it in the 12th century in 1178. And shortly, they only got as far as the third floor. And it started to sink. It started to rock over right there and then. It had a design floor. They put it in the ground. The soil itself was unstable. All of the ancient buildings around it are all having problems too. They only gave it a 3-meter or a 9-foot foundation, and they sail. So again, the design was flawed right from the beginning. But brethren, the foundation of God's temple cannot be flawed. It must be straight. It must be strong. It must be perfect. The question then, is the foundation of God's temple, is it perfect? Well, yes, it is. Let's go to 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 19. Nevertheless, the solid foundation of God stands. Solid foundation of God stands. Having this seal, the Lord knows those who are his, and let everyone who names the name of Christ depart from iniquity. There's a warning. Verse 20. But in a great house, is the building again, but in a great house, there are not only vessels of gold and silver, but also of wood and clay, some for honor and some for dishonor. Therefore, if anyone cleanses himself from the latter, he will be a vessel for honor, sanctified and useful for the master, prepared for every good. So there's our pre-Passover marching orders again. Now, he mentions vessels here. Now, these vessels might refer to all items that make up a house and household. Building materials, yes, but more than that, all the utensils that are in daily use in a house or, obviously, in a temple. In God's temple, the highest quality is mandatory. Look at the planks of wood that are used in the temple. Are inferior planks of wood acceptable? Of course not. They might be warped. And if they're warped, they're going to cause the building to be out of alignment as well. They're not going to pass the plumb line test. Let's go back to 1 Corinthians again, please. 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verses 8 and 9. In chapter 3 verse 8. Now he who plants and he who waters are one. And each one will receive his own reward according to his own labor. Verse 9. For we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field. You are God's building. Again, I love the way the Apostle Paul plays with language in such a wonderful way. Here, the Apostle Paul has just come into the end of an agricultural analogy. But at the end of verse 9, he words, you are God's building. He changes, he pivots on that, and he begins this analogy of a building project. Now, the Greek word for building here is oikodome. That's not okie dokie. Oikodome is O-I-K-O-D-O-M-A-Y. Oikodome can also mean an edifice, edification, building up, and promoting growth. Again, more marching orders for over. Continue in verse 10. According to the grace of God, which was given to me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation, and another builds on it. The Apostle Paul, being one of the apostles as part of the secondary foundation, and another builds on it. But let each one take heed how he builds on it. For no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now, if anyone builds on this foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay or straw, each one's work will become clear, for the day will declare it, because it will be revealed by fire. And the fire will test each one's work, that's the build, our building work, of what sort it is. If anyone's work which he has built on it endures, he will receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned, he will suffer loss. I'll leave that there for the time being. Any part that we have in this building project must be of the very, again, as with God's tent tabernacle and with the stone temples. There's a wonderful book that I have at home there. It's called the Tabernacle and the Service. I can't remember who the author is, but it goes into all of the file of how the old tent tabernacle was built. Really inspiring to, you know, sometimes we think it's just this tent. The quality of it, the quality of it is absolutely astounding. Again, everything should, there's got to be the highest quality, and only the very best will do. Inferior quality building materials are totally unacceptable and must be rejected. Just another thing on Italy there. A lot of the buildings in the hill towns of Italy are built with this tufa. And the builders probably loved it because the stone is soft and easy to work. But when they built their cities of it, and now these cities are, you know, as over the hundreds of years. What, again, we're still in, what is the building? Verse 16 here. Do you not know that you are the temple of God and that the Spirit of God do? If anyone defiles the temple of God, God will destroy him, for the temple of God is holy. Again, we need to drill that knowledge into our minds, brethren. So, of course, God, through the Apostle Paul, is referring to his holy temple, spiritual temple, and that it is, and again, Ephesians chapter 2, and I know some of this is repetition, but as we move through the different aspects of this building, Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 19, now therefore you are no longer strangers, foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God. There's that word household again. And again, his wonderful grammar and wordplay. He had a great way of transitioning from so here he's pivoting on the word household, and again the Greek oikios, and he makes this transition from the subtopic of our membership in the God family and the household of God over to the re. Having been built on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building being joined together grows into a holy temple in the Lord. Verse 22, in whom you also are being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. So here's the foundation again. Is it the same one? Is it the same foundation? Yes, it is. Jesus Christ is the rock. He's the rock solid main corner foundation stone on which everything else is laid. He's supported by the other main foundation stones, but secondary ones, faithful apostles and the prophets. We ask the question, so do we have the highest quality from the very start on the very basic level of the temple? You bet we do. Jesus Christ, his apostles, his prophets. So what about the subsequent layers of stones symbolizing various eras of God's church? Are they, or were they, of the highest quality too? Yes, they were. They may have been through some terrible times in some of those eras of the, but they were of the highest quality, and they were precious, and they are still precious to God. If they weren't, God would have rejected them. Another question, what about the current layer of the stones and pillars of God's church today? That's you and me, brethren. Are we of the highest quality? Are we? We must be. If we're not, brethren, we will be rejected. And we must strive to become perfect. Jesus said so. I mean, said to become perfect like his Father is perfect. He said that in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 48. And that's a whole nother sermon. But if we are doing our level best, obviously using the Holy Spirit and Jesus Christ that is within us, if we are doing our level best to become perfect, perfect quality stones and pillars, then Jesus promises to fill in the gaps in our perfection. again, that's another topic, and there are lots of scriptures to talk about that. Here's another question. The holy city and the eternal temple, which the foundation undergirds, is that a new concept? Is this something new? Is it something New Testament? Well, the answer is no. Let's go over to Hebrews chapter 11, and let's go back in history a little bit. Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 8. By faith, Abraham, years ago, by faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place he would receive as an inheritance, and he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he dwelt in the land of promise, as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents. It's Abraham. He's a man back in the year of the dwelling. Here he is, dwelling in tents, flimsy, temporary tents, with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he waited for the rock-solid city, which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Abraham saw in his eye, he saw the holy city thousands of years in verse 13. These all died in faith, all of these heroes of faith. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off. They assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were pilgrims on the earth. They as good as had the promises. They as good as had the city, but not quite. But what was the city that Abraham and the other heroes of faith could see in their mind's eye? Of course, we know that there was the actual Jerusalem, the physical Jerusalem that they really never got to live in. But what was the real city? To Revelation chapter 21. Revelation chapter 21 and verse 14. Revelation chapter 1 and verse 14. And the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and in them the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. This is with what Paul said that these secondary foundations were made up of the apostles, and there's the prophets part of it there. Again, the primary foundation stone, the head of the corner, Jesus Christ himself, never. And this is important because it's repeated over and over again. I don't have time to go into all of the scriptures now. The Apostle Peter and more in Revelation 21, and jump down to verse 19. And the foundations of the wall of the city were garnished with all manner of precious stones. Quality foundations, brethren, garnished with all manner of precious stones. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the fourth an emerald, on and on. Again, our pillars and our stones must be built on the same right foundation, that of Jesus Christ and the apostles, the prophets. Why? Why is it absolute? This gives the answer to that too. Let's go back to Luke chapter 6. Luke chapter 6. Luke chapter 6 and verse 47. Luke chapter. Whoever comes to me and hears my sayings and does them, I will show you whom he is. He is like a man building a house who dug deep and laid the foundation on the rock. I like the Leaning Tower of Pisa. This guy dug deep, way down to the rock. And when the flood arose, the stream beat vehemently against that house and could not shake it, for it was founded on the rock. But he who heard and did nothing is like a man who built a house on the earth without a foundation. Notice that he built on sand without a foundation, like Pisa, against which the stream beat vehemently, and immediately it fell, and the ruin of that house was great. So we must, brethren, build on the rock. We know which rock that is. We must align ourselves as well with Jesus Christ's straightness and uprightness. He is the standard. We must measure ourselves, and again, not against the imperial standard or the metric standard, but against the standard of Jesus Christ. Let's go back to Ephesians chapter 4 and pull one verse out there. Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 13. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 13. Till we all come to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, and there it is, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. There it is again. That is the standard. The measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. Okay, so let's start winding down a little bit now. Let's look at the final measurements and the ultimate temple. Let's go back to the book of Revelation again, and we'll jump in on a couple of chapters before we finish. Let's go to Revelation chapter 11 once again. I'm going to repeat this verse in Revelation chapter 11 and verse 1. And here we see God's angel commanding John, a human being again, to measure the temple. Revelation chapter 11 verse 1. Then I was given a reed like a measuring rod, and the angel stood, saying, Arise and measure the temple of God, the altar, and those who worship there. Now let's jump forward 10 chapters later in chapter 21. We see, let's go back to chapter 21, Revelation chapter 21. We see more measuring here, but there's differences. Some marked differences that jump right out at us. Revelation chapter 21 and verse 15. And he who talked with me, and this is an angel, had a gold reed to measure the city, its gates, and its wall. Verse 16. The city is laid out as a square. Its length is as great as its breadth. And he measured the city with the reed 12,000 furlongs. Its length, breadth. Then he measured its wall 144 cubits according to the measure of a man. That is, of an angel. So please note here that an angel, but please note also, angel was not measuring the temple, he was measuring the city. In fact, we don't see a temple at all. Why not? God tells us in verse 22, And I saw no temple therein, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are the temple of it. Spine-tingling verses in the whole, and imagine what it's going to be like when this is. Brethren, there'll be no more measuring of the temple will be necessary at that time. Why not? Because everything, all will be plumb, straight, and of a perfect measure relative to God's perfect standard of measurement. All will be one. And God's people at last will be in 100% unity and perfection with God the Father, with Jesus Christ, and with one another. All will be perfect. All imperfections will be negated. All will be perfect. But brethren, we're not there yet. We're not there yet, brethren. We still have some way to go. How long? I don't know. But we must keep on with our measuring of God's temple. Yes, in our pre-Passover self-examination, and also in our ongoing daily self-examination and the proper examination of God's true church. Brethren, arise and measure the temple.